Hello, I'm Annabelle Olivier. This is number 0272, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0272. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, another visit from Raymond Benson, the author of the five-book series, The Black Stiletto. The fifth book is now out.
I feel like it's my magnum opus. I'm really proud of it. It's really one big book broken out into five installments. So I guess you could call it a serial rather than a series. It's meant to be read from the first to the end. You know, like you wouldn't pick up the third Hunger Games book and read it before reading number one or two or whatever. That's what it's kind of meant to. Although hopefully if somebody does pick up like the third book or they would read it and still enjoy it. But it is a complete saga, almost like a miniseries on television.
Rocky Lang is the author of Growing Up Hollywood, Tales from the Son of a Hollywood Mogul. What was the genesis of this book?
It really was the genesis of came from a conversation with my daughters. One day we were sitting around just the breakfast room, and my older daughter said to me, "Dad, did Grandpa really get shot in the balls?" There was a pause, and I said, "Well, no, actually he didn't." And what they were referring to is a legendary Hollywood Babylon story about my father, who in the early 50s was having an affair with screen siren Joan Bennett, who was married to a wacky producer named Walter Wanger, who won some Academy Awards and did some pretty great films.
Plus, Stuart Nelman is along with another edition of Book Banter, and we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0272, was Annabelle Olivier, who is a weekend web producer at Global Montreal, the other place that I work. And thank you very much, Annabelle, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? 40-year-old Monica Milam allegedly stole a baseball bat from a Walmart store in Nashville, Tennessee, because as you know on this program, everything seems to happen at Walmart, or at least start there. After a few minutes, or at least a few minutes later, a police officer spotted what Monica wanted the bat for. She was allegedly using it to beat on a car. Monica ran, but was caught and allegedly admitted that she was attacking her ex-girlfriend's car. A few minutes later, Calvin McLean, the car's actual owner, showed up. Monica was arrested on suspicion of theft of merchandise and vandalism. McLean is considering pressing charges, saying this will be an inconvenience since he will have to ride the bus while his car is being repaired. And he'll also have to explain to his girlfriend how someone else's girlfriend hit his car because she thought it was her girlfriend's. Well, dear, it's all very complicated. Yeah. Meanwhile, here's a quote from the Circleville, Ohio police chief, a fellow by the name of Wayne Gray. "She was a very brave little girl." Who is he talking about? Well, he's talking about an 11-year-old girl who had accepted a ride in a bucket lift from an electrical contractor. Electrician Jeremiah Webb took her up for about 30 feet when he hit the overhead power lines. The shock threw Webb from the bucket, and he landed on a parked car. An autopsy, yes, he's no longer with us, an autopsy will be performed to determine if he was killed by the electrical shock or the fall. The girl wasn't injured, by the way, but had to wait in the bucket, watching over the scene until the power could be cut off and an electrical company lineman could rescue her with his own bucket truck. And why was Webb giving the girl a ride? Well, to show her how a bucket truck works, Gray said. More pointedly, he showed her how electricity works. And yes, I think we can add Jeremiah Webb to the annals of the Darwin File Award winners, because the tree of life is often self-pruning, as I said on this program time and time again, and You don't even need a high-flying bucket lift to do the pruning. Meanwhile, Texas prosecutors said a former school district officer told a woman she could go if she let him smell her feet or handed over her underwear. The Harris County District Attorney's Office said Cy-Fair School District Officer Patrick Quinn, who has since been fired, pulled over a woman at 3 a.m. August 11th for an expired sticker and told her that her vehicle smelled of marijuana. Quinn, who prosecutors said should not have been conducting traffic stops as a school resource officer, claims to have found a marijuana grinder in the woman's car. The woman, who denied ownership of the grinder, told authorities Quinn put her in the back seat of his patrol car. She said the officer told her that she could go free if she allowed him to smell her feet or if she gave him her underwear. Documents filed by prosecutors said Quinn told the woman if she allowed him to smell her feet, he was probably going to lick them too. However, Quinn apparently had a change of heart and told the woman to forget about it. The woman, who Quinn allowed to leave the scene, reported the incident the following day. Her insurance card was found at the scene of the traffic stop, and fingerprints on the card matched Quinn's, according to prosecutors. Quinn was charged with two counts of official oppression. Official oppression. You know, if he goes to prison, he may have to smell and lick someone's feet. I'm just saying. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a police responded to a house in Middletown, Pennsylvania, when a homeowner reported she heard several gunshots and then found a bullet hole in a window of her house. As she was checking the damage, a man came out of the house behind hers, firing a gun towards her house again, and then went back inside. An officer found more bullet holes in a fence between the two houses and another in the siding of the woman's home. Officers got a search warrant for the man's house and found several guns and ammunition. George Byrd IV, who is 31 years old and frankly should know better, admitted that he had been firing the guns, but only because he was unfamiliar with them and didn't know how to otherwise unload them. Yeah. Police say Byrd is not allowed to possess firearms because he is a convicted felon. He was, of course, arrested. This is actually progress, by the way, considering some of the stories you've had in the Stuff File program in the past, because usually gun owners that are this stupid put them against their heads to see if they're loaded or not. So, you know, we're advancing here. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Writer Raymond Benson has been keeping very busy. His final book in the Black Stiletto series is now out. It's the fifth book in the series, and this one is called The Black Stiletto: Endings and Beginnings. The series has been a unique twist on the crime fighter genre, and Raymond is on the line with us right now via Skype-to-Skype communications from Illinois. Hi, Raymond.
Hi, Peter. How's it going?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us once again.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We had a chance to talk to you back when you began the Black Stiletto saga. So now that it's finished, well, how do you feel about the process?
Well, I feel like it's my magnum opus. I'm really proud of it. You know, it's really one big book broken out into five installments. So I guess you could call it a serial rather than a series. It's meant to be read from the first to the end. It's, you know, like you wouldn't pick up the third Hunger Games book and read it before reading number one or two or whatever. That's what it's kind of meant to. Although hopefully if somebody does pick up like the third book or they would read it and still enjoy it. But it is a complete saga, almost like a mini series on television.
Now, we've had you on the program on several occasions talking about other things that you've written, including being one of the few people who've had a chance to write post Ian Fleming James Bond novels. So with the experience of what you have done in the past, how did you find it applying to something that you created from scratch with the Black Stiletto series?
Well, I've been writing my own stuff since 2002. That was when my last James Bond novel came out. So that was 12 years ago. And I've written a lot of other, original thrillers since then. Just finding my way and putting them out. But I guess one striking thing about The Black Stiletto is that it's told from a female perspective. And it's not the first time I've done that. There were at least three other novels that I wrote in the past 12 years that had female protagonists. So I don't know why, but I'm very comfortable writing from a female point of view. And The Black Stiletto's in first person, so I really had to get the voice right. I guess that was the biggest challenge.
Is it difficult? I mean, as you say, you had to get the voice right, because you know, is it difficult to write first person in the other gender? There are some people who have done it successfully in the past, and maybe some who have not. We were talking before off air about an Ian Fleming novel that I was not the biggest fan of, in which he did that. But do you find that there's some people who are more successful at that than others?
Well, I'm trying to think now right offhand who does do it. I know a lot of writers have done it in third person. The first person, I'm not really sure. I'd have to think about it. And I'm sure that it's been done. I'm sure it's been done. And probably done very well, and probably done very badly, too. For me, it was more a case because it's the woman's diaries. You know, you don't write in a diary the same way you speak. And so I tried to really capture how a woman writes in a diary. And luckily I have my wife, who is a big reader, a very intelligent reader. She reads all my stuff before anybody else does. So she was a good person to vet the manuscript. She would correct things if something really stuck out as a howler. But then, once the first book was finished, I let two or three female readers take a look at it who are also writers. And one of them said, "If I hadn't known this had been written by a man, I really would have thought it was written by a woman." So that sold it for me. So I think I did it.
Well, that was the question I was going to ask. And that is, since you've done this in a series of books, after the first one came out and you got reaction to it, did it change in any way how you worked on the subsequent stories?
No, not as far as her voice, because, the second book begins the day after the first book ends. And the third book begins the day after the second book ends. You know, it's all one continuous diary, basically. She just continues. It's just a continuation of her writing her exploits down.
Okay. Now, for those who aren't familiar with the books, The Black Stiletto is, I guess you can call her a retro superhero, a female superhero. Tell us a little bit about The Black Stiletto.
Okay, well, here's the 30-second elevator pitch. The Black Stiletto was a legend back in the late 50s, early 60s. She was a woman who put on a mask and a costume, called herself the Black Stiletto, went out on the streets of New York City and later Los Angeles to fight crime and social injustice. Nobody knew who she was, but she was active for 5 years and then mysteriously disappeared. During the intervening time, she became a myth, a legend. Everybody knew who the Black Stiletto was, but nobody knew who she really was. We cut to the present. There is a grown man taking care of his mother in a nursing home in the suburbs of Chicago, and she's dying of Alzheimer's. And he discovers that she was the legendary Black Stiletto. So it's really two parallel stories, one in the present, featuring the son mostly and his daughter, the other story, the parallel story, is her story in the past. So, it's an action adventure story on one hand, but it's also a family drama about Alzheimer's on the other.
And now that that all the books are out, the five books, it is taking on a new life. I understand that the book series rights for film have been picked up.
Yes, they have been optioned. So, we're just keeping our fingers crossed that they go beyond that.
Do you anticipate, or is it too early to tell, or do you anticipate having a say in how it's portrayed on the screen or who it's portrayed by, or would you be interested in doing the screenplay yourself?
Well, that's probably not a possibility. You know, Hollywood likes to hire, you know, real Writers Guild screenwriters and stuff. And I'm, but I would probably be like a creative consultant, especially if it was a TV series. I would be a consultant, but, you know, they do what they want to do. They buy the rights and they can do what they want. You know, that's just kind of the way Hollywood works. You know, how many times have you seen a movie and you go, gosh, that wasn't anything like the book? That's just the, you know, unless you find, you know, the people who are going to do it, unless they're so married to the original story and they really want to do a faithful adaptation, then, you know, you can almost bet that it's not going to be like, you know, your work. So, you know, basically, you know, I hear writers all the time saying, oh, they changed my story. But they also say, well, you know, I cashed the paycheck. So I guess they can do whatever they want.
When you started writing the first one, did you know how the fifth one was going to end, or did you learn things along the way during the writing process as to how the story was unfolding?
Yes, I did know. I conceived the whole thing as a five-book story. I knew what happened. Of course, I knew what happened in the first book because I was writing it, and I knew pretty much how it was going to end, you know, how I was going to wind it up. What I didn't know was what happens in book two, three, and four. So as I got to each one of those, you know, it was kind of a fresh new way, but I also knew that I had to work toward the ending that I had in mind. So to answer your question, I kind of had book one and book five pretty much in my head when I started, and then you know, did the other three in between from scratch.
You gave the elevator pitch earlier, but we should also mention that there's a website, theblackstiletto.net, and on that website there is a video trailer right on the front page for the book, right?
Right. There's actually two trailers. The first one you see was made for the first book back in 2011, and it's a pretty elaborate trailer. I went to Hollywood, and I got a professional filmmaker to shoot it. I wrote the script and produced it, and we got actors and costumes and a set, and you know, really kind of did it up. It's more an infomercial than it is a trailer. So you know, people should take a look at that at theblackstiletto.net. And then I did do a lighter trailer, you know, not one as elaborate, for the third book, and that's on there. There's also a downloadable free teaser short story on that website, and a song that you got, the Black Stiletto theme song that you can download, and lots of photos and information and other stuff.
Well, excellent. Congratulations on the conclusion of writing the series, the five-book series, The Black Stiletto. What's next for you?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I have started a new book, an original book, with a female protagonist again, go figure. I don't know where, you know, it's too early to even really talk about it. I do a lot of tie-in work. That's good bread and butter work. Media tie-in work, that's like novelizations of TV shows or movies or video games. The past, you know, 10 years, I've done a lot of that kind of work. I just finished one. I worked on it all spring and most of the summer. It's for a video game that's going to come out in 2015. So I can't really say what it is yet. It's still under wraps. But that's what I just completed that about a month or two ago.
Well, again,
I just keep my options open.
Excellent. Well, again, congratulations on all the things that you do, and congratulations on The Black Stiletto. And I really do hope it takes off either on the big or the small screen. I thank you once again for being on the program with us, Raymond.
Well, thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Raymond Benson, author of The Black Stiletto, Endings and Beginnings. His website for the book is theblackstiletto.net. And as I mentioned, you'll find a great video trailer right on the front page. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0272, and you'll find links to Raymond's sites, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
If you're listening to this while walking with your iPod, make sure you look both ways before you cross the street. It's safety first on The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to somebody who grew up in Hollywood. Stuart Nolman is along with another edition of Book Banter. And we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on the program. And more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a show also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, police in Pennsylvania said a man who dressed as the yellow Teletubby and broke into a friend's home for leftover Chinese food has been charged with burglary. Bethlehem police said Lehigh University student, 20-year-old Therese Owens Jr., was dressed as Lala, the yellow Teletubby, when he allegedly broke into a friend's home at about 2 a.m. Sunday and filled his man purse with leftover Chinese food from the refrigerator. The door to the residence was damaged during the break-in. Officers caught up to Owens, who police said was dressed up for a nearby Halloween party shortly after the incident, but he was released when the victim initially declined to press charges. I guess the victims thought about it and the landlord got involved with the damage, according to Bethlehem Police Chief Mark DeLuzio. Owens has now been charged with burglary. The chief said the case was unusual for the department. Not that many Teletubbies get arrested, he said. You can't make it up. Now, wouldn't you know it, this is one of the rare times when I can't find an accompanying mugshot anywhere. Now, wouldn't that be priceless? Yeah. Meanwhile, speaking of criminals, Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks publisher of state secrets who remains holed up in the embassy of Ecuador in London, has signed on with an Icelandic licensing agent to sell Assange-branded high-end clothing, shoes, and various household goods in India and much of Europe, and is negotiating to put his logo on apparel in Japan and the United States. The agent told the New York Times in October that WikiLeaks and Assange can be as big as Coca-Cola. Wow, how delusional are these people? Anyway, a 46-page book sets out licensing standards, for example, no tacky slogans such as "We Steal Secrets," and includes the one approved Assange portrait, an idealized line drawing of him gazing soulfully into what is presumably a better future. Yeah. Seriously, he's technically a fugitive of the law. Shouldn't his assets and the opportunity to license goods be frozen? I mean, isn't that just normal jurisprudence? Anyway, moving right along. When Branford County Sheriff Gordon Smith described the accident, he said, "The woman said that when she noticed the truck driver coming up behind her was not stopping, she released the brake and tried to mash the gas. The accident took place in Stark, Florida. And investigators say 35-year-old Shannon Ford was driving a log truck and rear-ended a school bus that was unloading students. Witnesses say Ford had been driving erratically for several miles and never applied his brakes. Ford, his passenger, the bus driver, and seven students were seriously injured in the crash. The truck passenger, 34-year-old Sherry Ford, may have contributed to the accident. The female passenger of the truck was found partially clothed, Smith said. That is part of our investigation. Police believe Mrs. Ford may have been actively, well, you know, performing a sexual act on Mr. Ford before the crash. That's where I was going with that. Witnesses also say the partially, in partially clothed, may have been because of a towel that officers gave her when they arrived at the scene. Well, at least he wasn't texting and driving, huh? I've actually passed a vehicle on a highway one bright sunny day in which a couple were engaged in some kind of activity, which I will not describe here in detail, as I was passing them. And I'm surprised he was able to stay on the road. That's all I'm saying. Ask me about it one day. I'll tell you in full detail. And we have time for one more Stuff File news story before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A U.S. airman on leave in Minnesota said he was sorely mistaken when he thought it would be incredibly funny to give a police officer a wet willy. 24-year-old Riley Lewis Swearingen of Goldsboro, North Carolina, pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor disruptive intoxication charge in connection with a Saturday incident involving the defendant, two moistened fingers, and both of a Mankato police sergeant's ears. District Judge Kurt Johnson heard Swearingen, who is visiting Minnesota while on leave from the Air Force, was boarding the drunk bus after the downtown bars closed early Saturday when he decided to carry out a wet willy prank when he spotted a uniformed police sergeant. Swearingen licked a finger on each hand and then inserted them into both of the sergeant's ears, the court heard. Commander Jeremy Clifton said Swearingen was immediately arrested. A charge of assaulting a police officer with bodily fluids was dropped in exchange for Swearingen's guilty plea. I thought it would be incredibly funny to give a police officer a wet willy, to which I was sorely mistaken, Swearingen told Johnson. I'm incredibly sorry for what I did. I never thought I would be going to jail for the weekend. Swearingen was sentenced to the 3 days he had already spent in jail and ordered to pay $77 in court costs. Friends, Romans, police sergeants, lend me your ears. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Rocky Lang grew up the son of a mega film producer, so he knows a thing or two about growing up in Hollywood. And that's the book he has written. It's called Growing Up Hollywood, Tales from the Son of a Hollywood Mogul. And Rocky joins us on the line right now from Los Angeles. Hi, Rocky.
Hey, how are you? It's great to be back on the show with you. It's been a long time.
It's a pleasure having you back on the program with us. Last time in the old radio program that we did, we talked about your book about emergency rooms.
Yes, Confessions of Emergency Room Doctors. It was a lot of fun, a little crazy time and a crazy book.
So as I mentioned in the introduction, you grew up the son of a Hollywood producer, Jennings Lang, who did such films as Earthquake, the Airport movies, and several others. So what made you at this point in your life decide, I have to write this book?
It really was the genesis of, came from a conversation with my daughters, who are now 23 and 19. And one day we were sitting around just the breakfast room, and my older daughter said to me, hey, Dad, did Grandpa really get shot in the balls? And there was a pause, and I said, well, no, actually he didn't. And what they were referring to is a legendary Hollywood Babylon story that, about my father, who in the early 50s was having an affair with screen siren Joan Bennett, who was married to a wacky producer named Walter Wanger, who won some Academy Awards and did some pretty great films. And Bennett was not happy in her marriage, and my dad was not happy in his marriage. And the two of them started to have an affair, which actually was held in the apartment of a man named Jay Cantor, who was a junior agent at the then MCA agency in Beverly Hills. And my dad would use his apartment to have his tryst with Joan Bennett, the actress. And that was actually the apartment that was the genesis for the movie The Apartment by Billy Wilder and Jack Lemmon years later. So anyway, my dad took Joan off to a meeting for a television show. And when he returned with Joan to the agency parking lot, Wanger appeared out of the shadows and took shot at his family jewels and missed. But as a legend in Hollywood precedes truth, the story has been written as Jennings Lang was shot in the balls. And you can read it in all the Babylon books and whatnot. So what I did is I told the story to my children, and I told it through the eyes of a 13-year-old, which was me, the day that I found out that this happened. When I came to school, and I was 13 years old, and my best friend came running across the playground blacktop saying, "My mother said your father was shot in the balls. Hey, Lang, my mother said your father was shot in the balls." This was the first time I heard the story. Of course, the whole playground went silent, and I spent this entire day looking at the clock, wanting to get home to find out if this was true or not. And the questions that the kids asked me the whole day. So I'm running home, and there's this maid who worked for us who looks sort of like a Maytag washing machine with a head on it, big stocky woman. And I'm like, "Hey, Mary, was my dad shot in the balls?" And she said, "How the hell do I know he was shot in the balls? I don't see your father's balls." And I ran up the stairs to my mother, and I said to my mom, "Mom," and my mom heard the question, and she says, "That's something you're going to have to ask your dad."
Wow.
And so then I had to wait for my dad to come home, and I leave the rest for the book. So anyway, I wrote this. Nikki said to me, "Dad, you should write this all down." And so I wrote this story down, and the Huffington Post picked it up, and I thought, you know what? I have a lot of really funny stories about growing up in Hollywood. Now, this event happened before I was born and happened before my mother married my father. It was a first marriage. And I continue to write these stories about growing up in this amazing, you know, lifestyle where, you know, Steven Spielberg was at our house all the time before he became the great Steven Spielberg. He was just a kid, and he was under contract to Universal. And there's stories about when I played tennis with Clint Eastwood and how I had peanuts with Jimmy Carter and this sort of whole crazy world of Hollywood growing up. And I ultimately became a director, a writer, and a producer myself doing movies, but not at the level of Hollywood and Beverly Hills in the 70s. And that is really where the book came from.
Now, some of the other stories you share, I mean, you've told your story on a story on your dad about, you know, before he was married to your mom with his first wife. So let's talk about your mom, too. I understand that she slept with Ronald Reagan.
She did. She slept with Ronald Reagan, and I found out about that one night when I was a little bit older than 13. I was probably, I guess, maybe in my early 20s or late teens. And we were eating at a restaurant that was called Chasen's, which is a legendary Hollywood fare that is now since closed. And very elegant restaurant, and you know, you could find all the mega stars of the old day, whether it was Bogart and Bacall or, you know, Gregory Peck, Walter Pidgeon, John Huston. I mean, these are people who always, you know, frequent, and Dean Martin was always there, Sammy Davis, Frank. I mean, it was an amazing restaurant that we would go to all the time. And another couple loved this restaurant, and that was Ronnie and Nancy. And so one night I'm having my parents there. And Tommy Gallagher, who was the captain, captain waiter, came and said, "Oh, you know, who's in the back? And, you know, Ronnie and Nancy here." And this was just after he left the White House, and it was back to California. And my dad said, you're lucky, Rock. You know, your mom could have married Reagan, and you wouldn't be eating dinner tonight." And I said, "What does that mean?" And so the story got revealed that after Reagan had divorced Jane Wyman, and he and my mom dated for a couple of years, and Ronnie asked my mom to get married, and she declined. She thought he was a very nice guy. He was, by the way, a Democrat there, very liberal, and president of the Screen Actors Guild. But she said no, and Nancy Davis, who was also an actress, you know, had her eyes on him, and you know, it was a very, very strong. They obviously had a very strong marriage, and for many, many years. But the story that is within that book, which I will not reveal the end of, is that if you read the story about how my mother slept with Ronald Reagan, there is a term that Ronald Reagan gave to himself that will make you never think of him in the same light again. It is quite hysterical and very revealing.
Okay. Now, speaking of hysterical and revealing, in telling your story, should anybody within the Hollywood community be worried about what you're saying in your book? Have you told stories out of school, as the saying goes?
No, I don't. I never told stories out of school because that was not the intent of the book. I have actually changed the names of some people to protect them because the intention was not to, you know, to do any harm or to hurt anybody. It was really my point of view on what had happened. There certainly are some stories, I mean, that have not been told. I was right in the middle of a very, very serious fight between Dustin Hoffman and Sidney Pollack during The Making of Tootsie when I was directing a film about The Making of Tootsie, and those stories had not been told. Certainly the story about my father that has not been told in the way that I have told the truth and sort of set the record straight. There are other things along the way that have never been told because they just haven't been written about, and I witnessed them, and I felt that they were worthy ideas to be discussed and have fun with. But no, there's nobody in it who I think would be object to what I said. In fact, I got a wonderful phone call from Jay Cantor, who had the apartment my dad is in. Jay's in his 80s, and he called me yesterday. He's very complimentary about the book, and it was wonderful to hear it from him because you never know how anybody's going to react when you use the name in a piece of writing.
Just the title itself, Growing Up Hollywood. When people think of Growing Up Hollywood, they either think of one or two extremes, an idyllic childhood where you have everything waiting for you hand and foot and everything is great and wonderful, or a childhood where you're neglected or are delinquent or are causing troubles. And there never seems to be stories about, you know, somewhere in between.
I think it all comes down to parenting. I mean, you know, my parents were self-made. You know, my dad drove out here with $40 in his pocket and worked as a janitor at thrifty drugstores at a store and he had to eat horse meat, you know, before he sort of found his way. And my mom was a depression kid and who became extremely successful in her own right, Monica Lewis, and had a big career at MGM. And, so they certainly came from the school of hard knocks. And even though my dad did incredibly well in the business and we lived in Beverly Hills, he and my mom always made sure that I understood, what was really important in life, and it was just really content of people's characters and not the size of their bank accounts. And it was sort of drilled into me, and I witnessed it firsthand. We had, you know, amazing people all over the house who were not only intellectual or incredibly wealthy and successful, but also struggling artists and, you know, down on their out former tennis players who played Wimbledon. And, you know, it was a really very wonderful, wonderful event. And we had these major parties too, which, I wanted to share with you. We had a party, I don't remember how old I was, early 70s. And it was for the Daniel Ellsberg Defense Fund after he had released the Pentagon Papers during the Vietnam War and was on trial for espionage, sort of like an Edward Snowden of the day. And there was a party for his defense. And I got up in the middle of the night. I was hungry. And I went down into the kitchen, and sitting around our kitchen table was Ringo Starr and John Lennon, Yoko Ono, and Barbara Streisand. And just sitting around the table. And I was like, oh, my God, the Beatles. And it was, I sort of went up to bed, and I don't think I slept that night. And the next morning, my mom said that Ringo and John and the group had smoked some weed, and they actually put the butts out in a Miro sculpture, which is a very famous artist thinking it was an ashtray. So that's sort of the world I sort of grew up in.
Well, I've got just about a minute left, or less than a minute. I got to ask this question, and that is, you grew up in Hollywood. Do you think it was more fun or easier growing up in Hollywood when you grew up, or would it be more difficult or more fun today?
Well, I think that's a tough question because my experience was unique in that it was just my experience, and because I was so close to my parents, and the book in many ways is a love letter to my dad, my experience was a wonderful experience. I have a very sort of, middle class life now. I'm a writer, your kid's in college and, trying to pay the bills and doing all of that. And so my life is very different, far away from that life. But I'm having fun now, and I had a hell of a lot of fun then, and I can't speak for what's going on today.
Okay. The book is called Growing Up Hollywood, Tales from the Son of a Hollywood Mogul. It's written by Rocky Lang. Rocky, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always great talking to you.
Rocky Lang, author of Growing Up Hollywood, Tales from the Son of a Hollywood Mogul. And by the way, Rocky also has another book out that is worth mentioning. It's called If You Thought Your Divorce Was Bad, Wait Until You Read This Book. And hopefully we'll have a chance in a few weeks to visit with Rocky again and talk about that book too. Sounds like a lot of fun. In the meantime, you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0272, and you'll find the links to Rocky's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. I recently received a check in the mail for over $100 as my share of a lawsuit I'd never heard about. You can probably imagine my surprise. Here's what happened. A few years ago, we dropped our iPod in a bucket of water. Not surprisingly, it stopped working, so we took it to Apple to see if it could be fixed. It couldn't, but since it was our fault, we just accepted it as one of those unfortunate things that happen in life. Case closed. At least, I thought it was closed, but a lawyer somewhere decided that anyone who soaked their iPod in water should be paid. So he filed a class action lawsuit against Apple. I think it should have been dismissed, but it forced Apple to rack up huge legal bills, so it decided to cut its losses and settle. Let's be fair. Some people might say that Apple has so much money that this is just, if you'll pardon the pun, a drop in the bucket to them. Take the check and be happy. But fair is fair, so we did the only thing I thought we could do. To find out, visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses, but recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And we do indeed have Mr. Stuart Nauman with another edition of Book Banter. Stu, how are you, sir?
Fine, Peter. Well, let's hear the crowd roar.
Roar! Roar!
Okay.
Well, and because hockey season's well underway.
Yes, on and in Canada on apparently several networks. Try and find the game. It's like a shell game or whack-a-mole.
It's one big search, actually. But, there was a time where, when you want to watch a hockey game or listen to a hockey game, whether it be the Canadians, the Leafs, or whatever, you only have to just go to one place.
And that would be?
Well, the CBC, Hockey Night in Canada.
Well, that's not true. You also had, in our childhood, we also had CTV for a while.
That's right.
On Wednesday nights.
But it was, that's right. You're absolutely right about that. But you didn't have to, you know, scramble to find where, you know, what channel your team was going to be playing on, if you know what I mean. But speaking of CBC and hockey, you know, what started out 30 years ago as an essay for a CBC radio broadcast and later a short story and National Film Board of Canada animated short film has become one of the most iconic children's books to come out of Canada about the country's iconic national sport, which is hockey. One of its most revered players ever to put on a pair of skates, which is Morris the Rocket Richard. And to celebrate the milestone anniversary of Rock Carey's legendary story of hockey worship, Tundra Books has just released a special 30th anniversary edition of The Hockey Sweater. Now, in case if you're a part of the minority that haven't yet read Carrier's autobiographical story, it takes place in the rural Quebec village of Saint-Justin during the late 1940s, and it was a place and time when Rock and his friends spent practically all their free time at the local rink playing nonstop hockey, or shinny, as they would call it, wearing their Bleu Blanc Rouge Montreal Canadiens hockey sweaters as they emulated their common idol Maurice Richard and spent their Saturday nights gathered around the radio listening to Richard and the Habs tear up the ice against their five NHL opponents. This is the original six era we're talking about.
Right.
However, young Rock's Canadiens sweater has become all worn and tattered, so his mother decides to buy him another one through the Eaton's catalog. But when the much-anticipated package arrives in Saint-Justin, Rock is horrified to discover that someone from Eaton's made a major mistake and instead sent in the blue and white sweater of, gasp, the Toronto Maple Leafs.
It was probably that fat English lady.
Oh, the one who worked in the mail order department in Toronto.
Yeah.
So young Rock is torn over what to do with his Maple Leaf sweater. Should he wear it to please his mom or risk the taunts from his friends at the rink at what could be regarded as an act of hockey sacrilege? But this special anniversary edition of The Hockey Sweater not only gives future generations of young readers the chance to read such a very beloved book, but also celebrate the history and delightful legacy of what this story has done for children's literature in Canada, as well as the sport of hockey. You find out how the humble origins of the story, how it all evolved, how illustrator Sheldon Cohen developed the drawings that graced the book and has become just as revered as the text, the significance of the Montreal Canadiens and the Eaton's catalog to the way of life in rural Quebec during the 40s, and testimonials from several prominent Canadians on how the hockey sweater has become such a major part of the Canadian cultural landscape, including Prime Minister Harper, Justin Trudeau, Haley Wickenheiser, Peter Mansbridge, and astronaut Robert Thirsk, who took a copy of the book with him to the International Space Station. And as an added bonus for this book, it also has a DVD that contains the award-winning National Film Board animated short that was based on the book.
The copy that Thirsk took to the International Space Station, he didn't leave it there, did he? Because if it's a book that he got from a library, could you imagine the due fees on that?
Yeah, that's astronomical, so to speak.
Absolutely.
Like, way out of this world. But the 30th anniversary edition of The Hockey Sweater is a wonderful treasure of a book about the power of a national sport that has and still has on the youth of Canada, whether you spent your winters on the ice wearing the Bleu Blanc Rouge, or, and yes, even the blue and white.
Hmm. And, I mean, since that's such an iconic Canadian book, I'm almost afraid to ask, what other types of things do you recommend in that reading genre?
Well, if you think I'm going to recommend a book by Toronto Maple Leafs, I don't have that. I have a book called The Lions in Winter, which was probably one of the first in-depth histories of the Montreal Canadiens that was written. It was written by Chris Goines and Alan Turowitz. It was published in 1986. Terrific book. And if you really want to dig back a little bit further, there's another interesting history of the Montreal Canadiens that's out of print. But if you find it, you got to read it. It was by a former Montreal Star hockey writer, Andy O'Brien, called Fire Wagon Hockey, which talks about the Montreal Canadiens history up until about 1970, actually.
I'm surprised you didn't have any children's books about the Toronto Maple Leafs, because, you know, children do love fairy tales.
And I think they haven't written that fairy tale yet about the 67 Leafs.
Yes, the 67 Leafs. Anyway, this week's book was... I'm not going to say anymore, because I'll just get myself in trouble. This week's book was...
Well, it's called The Hockey Sweater 30th Anniversary Edition by Rock Carrier and Sheldon Cohen, published by Tundra Books, and it's $21.99.
By the way, you know the difference between the team photos of the Toronto Maple Leafs Stanley Cup champions and the Montreal Canadiens Stanley Cup champions, right?
What's that? Some had more teeth than others?
No, ours are in color. Say goodnight, Stuart.
Good night, Peter. And we shoot, we score cannonading shots all around.
And how can people find you?
Well, if you're not doing any cannonading shots, you could read me in the Montreal Times every week, or go online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Stuart Allman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about in the home stretch here on the Stuff File program. We have a few more Stuff File news stories to get through. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, firefighters in Tennessee freed an 18-month-old boy who climbed into one of those stuffed animal claw machines while his grandmother's back was turned at a laundromat. Diane O'Neill, grandmother to Maryville toddler Colin Lambert, said she looked up from checking a text message at a laundromat just in time to see the boy climbing into the machine through the prize slot. All I could see was his feet. He had already crawled in, she said. I grabbed his feet and he kicked my hand and got in, climbed up over the glass partition and sat down in the toys. The boy was rescued by firefighters within a matter of minutes, and they allowed Colin to keep one of the stuffed animals from inside the machine. O'Neill said her grandson is, quote, a sweet little monster, unquote, with a tendency to climb his way into trouble. Nothing surprises me with him. You just have to expect the worst, and it usually happens, she said. Colin's mom, Bridget Lambert, said she wasn't at all surprised by the incident. She tells me, and then she shows me a picture, and my husband and I started laughing because we're not surprised. It was a matter of time before he did something like this, Lambert said. Now, you see, my problem with this whole story is they allowed him to keep one of the stuffed animals from inside the machine. They're just enabling this larcenous child who clearly, as the story later states, has no boundaries to getting what he wants. He's only 18 months old. Let's check his record, emphasis on record, when he's 18. Yeah. An unidentified woman called police to report that her ex-boyfriend had broken into her house at 1:25 a.m. After kicking in her front door, he went into her bedroom and began throwing things at her and her new boyfriend, then started beating on her in view of her two children. Actually, their two children, as in his and her two children, who were ages 3 and 4. The attack was apparently stopped by her dog when it bit him in the groin. Yeah. He was not only hospitalized, but the bite was apparently so severe, he was transferred to a larger hospital in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Well, it sounds like the two children he had with his ex will be the end of his lineage. As for the canine, who's a good dog? Who's a good dog? Who's a good dog? Moving right along, a 22-year-old Owen Reese was arrested in October in Sparta, Wisconsin for reckless endangerment when he answered a knock on his door from fundraising Cub Scouts by swinging a sword wildly. Reese told police that he always answers the door with his sword to protect himself against religious people. Wow. Sounds like someone had some previous trauma in a church. Well, I wouldn't necessarily make him the idiot of the day. He's just someone with quirky religious thoughts. That's about all. But here now, boys and girls, well, this next story, this is the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
24-year-old Jonathan Warrenfels and a buddy were charged with robbing 5 sunbathers in Dania Beach, Florida at gunpoint in October. Now, police quickly picked up the two based on a lookout for the only man around with the word misunderstood tattooed in large letters across his forehead, as Warrenfels actually has misunderstood tattooed across his forehead. Like, you couldn't think to wear a bandana if you were going to rob people, buddy? I mean, why would someone rob people at gunpoint with such a unique tattoo displayed across their forehead? Well, two reasons in this case. One, because he really is misunderstood. And two, because he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0272. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0272. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it for this week's show. See you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.